Now it's time to be educated and entertained by the country's most famous environmental scientist, Joey Bia's research grizzly bears, wolves, and birds of prey. He continues to travel all across America to bring you the very best that nature has to offer. Be ready to be amazed. Here's your host, Joey B.
Hello and welcome to Joey B. Outdoor Science and Nature. Man, do I have the coolest job. I travel all across America to bring you the very best that nature has to offer. This show today is all about the Sauerland Mountain Preserve. I have a special guest via Zoom, Carolyn Klebe. She is a steward program coordinator for the Sauerlands Conservancy. Carolyn, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I am excited to listen. In our discussion for the prep for the show, you discussed about the actual number of preserves in the area, and I was just amazed by that. So why don't you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. So the Sauerland Mountain region is a 90 square mile region in central New Jersey, and it is defined by the die-based rock of this region. And in the Sauerlands, there are 26 public preserves.
Well, the 26, they're not all Sauerlands Preserve. I keep seeing DNR Greenway signs as well. So do you know about that?
Oh, sure. So we don't actually own those preserves. They are owned by DNR Greenway, Friends of Hopewell Valley Open Space, Mercer County Park Commission, Hunterdon County, and a number of different municipalities in this region. So there are 7 municipalities in the Sauerland Mountain region. And the Sauerland Conservancy works with these different organizations and municipalities to help steward the land or do restoration projects. So we don't own the land, but these preserves are within the Sauerland Mountain region itself.
All right, then the follow-up question to that would be, who provides the stewardship for these preserves?
So that's a great question. A lot of it is done by the landowner and in collaboration with municipalities, different types of volunteer groups, the Sauerland Conservancy, which is the organization that I work for, some school groups, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, all different types of organizations will get together and collaborate on the stewardship projects.
Well, are farmers involved in this as well? Because obviously, we're talking about preserve lands and really adjoining to farmlands, which obviously my farm is adjoined to the Sauerland Preserve. So why don't you tell me about that?
So we have not typically had farm organizations participate, but there has been some collaborative work and programs that we've done with NOFA, the Northeast Organic Farming Association. So there have been some presentations, and we've had different types of talks with them, but we haven't had any farm organizations per se do stewardship work within the Sauerlands. But I wanted to mention that New Jersey Conservation Foundation recently purchased a large amount of land in the Sauerlands, and it was just preserved over on Wurtsville Road in Hunterdon County. So we have another big piece of preserved land that was just added to the Sauerlands.
That's a great thing, because that's right down the road from me. So
yes.
Makes me happy. You also mentioned that there was a pilot program, the Watershed Institute. Can you discuss that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, we partner with a lot of different organizations. So one of those projects is with the Watershed Institute and NJDEP and the New Jersey Watershed Ambassadors. And so we have a pilot program with them for a stream monitoring program where volunteers with the Sauerland Conservancy will go to a training at the Watershed Institute, and it's taught by Aaron Stress, which is the assistant director of science over there, and some folks from NJDEP, including Debbie Kratzer, and they give a stream school, and participants participate in this weekend-long stream school and then get tested to assess their skills with stream monitoring as far as data collection and identification of aquatic macroinvertebrates. And when they complete their certification process, they'll be able to go out and collect data and submit it to the Water Quality Exchange Network at NJDEP.
That is great because, again, it is bringing, and I always say the importance of, we call them the locals, the people that live here that can actually participate and be active in making a difference. And I think that's very important.
Yeah, we have such a fabulous group of volunteers and members that, you know, the work that we do couldn't happen without them. The Starling Conservancy, we say, has a staff of 2.5. There's one full-time staff and 3 part-time staff members. So, you know, we get a lot done, but we have to rely on our volunteers and our members to get the colossal amount of stewardship work and advocacy work and education and outreach that we do. We depend on them, and they're wonderful.
Yes, and yes, they are. And you also mentioned that you did a project with, I guess, some restoration with Trout Unlimited. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So we did a restoration project with them and DNR Greenway this October. We did a Roots for Rivers restoration project, which is a riparian restoration. And I know that you know what a riparian zone is, but for some folks that are listening, they might not know. And the riparian zone is the area alongside of a river or a stream. And it's really important for filtering pollutants coming into that stream to stabilize the stream bank so erosion won't happen, and to shade the water to keep it cool. And so we partnered with Trout Unlimited and DNR Greenway, and we planted 500 trees along Stony Brook over near the Cedar Ridge Preserve.
And it's funny that I know that besides you telling me, because I just moved from a different Trout Unlimited, we call it TU chapter, to this chapter. And I just spoke to one of the TU members, and he was actually part of that restoration. So like 2 days ago, two days after I spoke to you about it, he was bragging on, they just took care of that. So I think that was just a real neat thing.
Yeah. I mean, when you work together, you can get more good stuff done. And so that's, you know, a great thing about collaborating with other organizations, municipalities and school groups and you know, different types of organizations. And we really love partnering.
Nice. This show was brought to you by Ramsey Outdoor Stores. Whether you shop online or one of their stores, your experience will successfully gear you up for your next adventure. Go to RamseyOutdoor.com. Now, let us talk a little bit about the ecology of the area, the Sourlands, and some of the problems that it's facing. And one of the questions I wanted to pose to you was, with the forest that we have here and the invasive species, the emerald ash borer, can you address that, please?
Sure. So the Sourland Mountain, like I said, is a 90 square mile of contiguous forest. It's the largest piece of contiguous forest in central New Jersey. And it's a really important stopover for migratory birds and an important habitat corridor for many other terrestrial animals. And so right now, one of the big issues that we're facing is the emerald ash borer, which is a beetle that was brought into Michigan in 2002, and it made its way down here, I believe, in 2012 into New Jersey. And the Sourland Forest imparts its 20% ash, and up to other areas near Beltane Mountain, it's 70% ash. And the emerald ash borer is really going to devastate our forest, and we're slated to lose about 1 million trees. And so in combination with that, another issue that we have is the overabundance of white-tailed deer. There's about 10 to 15 times the amount of deer here now than there was before European settlers came. So with a combination of losing all these trees from the emerald ash borer and an overabundance of deer, we're really in a big trouble. And, you know, deer are native to this region. There's nothing wrong with white-tailed deer. But when there's so many white-tailed deer, they're eating all the saplings in the forest because there's nothing for them else to eat. And so when these ash trees die, there's not this understory of saplings waiting to replace that canopy when it's gone. And so, you know, we're working really hard on a reforestation plan to deal with this, you know, decline of ash and the death of 1 million ash trees in the next few years. you know, and there are other invasive problems. The spotted lanternfly just came across the river. And, you know, there are invasive plants that are here too. So we're kind of hitting it from all angles. We're doing invasive species removal. We're doing planting. We're, you know, trying to fence off areas to keep white-tailed deer from coming in. So we're trying to hit it at all different angles to try to mitigate this big loss.
Now, in the restoration program for the forest themselves, do we have plantings going on with some of the little steel cages fencing around some of the trees directly in the forest because of the deer? It's overgrazing from that perspective.
Yep. So we're doing all different management types. So sometimes we will take, you might see it on some of the different preserves, these little steel metal cages around individual trees. Because there's already a great seed bank established, that we don't necessarily always have to plant trees everywhere. Sometimes it's just a matter of protecting them from deer herbivory. So you might see individual cages in areas. Other places you might see a big fence keeping the deer out. A lot of the organizations that we're working with also have deer management programs trying to manage that population of deer. So, you know, there's just so many different ways that we're tackling. And I don't necessarily think one way is the best way or, you know, the way that we'll be able to accomplish our goals. I think we really need to be open-minded and work with as many organizations as we can and try as many different ways as we can to get this reforestation going.
Well, you know that as a scientist yourself, you know that experimentation is it, and someone else may have the answer. So if we limit what's going to happen, we may be limiting an answer. So we need to make sure that if somebody else wants to try something and it works, there's smiles on everyone's face.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's different parts of the Sourland Forest that are post-agriculture, and there's ones that haven't had agriculture on it. And so the challenges that those two different soil types face are different. So we have to treat them differently. So there's not one blanket solution for everything. So, you know, there's a lot of different organizations working really hard and in collaboration with each other to come up with the best solution for each restoration site that we're working on.
Absolutely. And now, you know, I mentioned to you that I did research out in Idaho, non-native plant species out in the sagebrush steppe. And I know that there, you mentioned that there is a New Jersey invasive strike team. And number one, it's just a cool name. And then I'm going, can you tell me about the purpose of this group?
Sure. Mike Van Cleef is the head of the New Jersey invasive strike team, Dr. Mike Van Cleef. He is just a wealth of knowledge, and there is a crew that he works with, and they monitor the invasive species that are in New Jersey. And it's not just plants, it's also insects and other types of organisms. And they have a yearly conference where they talk about the different issues that they're having and management of them. And it's just such a wonderful resource to find out more information about, you know, emerging invasive species and how to handle an infestation that you might have. They've just been phenomenal. Whenever I have a question about, you know, I found this invasive species, what's the best way to handle it? You know, turning over to the strike team and asking Dr. Mike Van Cleef has just been, you know, answered all my questions. It's really great.
And you know this, it's great to have that resource. Anytime you have the question, there's an answer coming, and it's a good answer.
Absolutely.
Now, speaking about some of the native species, plant and animal that are here, you mentioned that there's some bobcat in the area, and I was really impressed about that.
Yeah, there have been bobcat seen in the Sourlands, and you know that's something that is really important for bobcats and for all animals really, is the ability to move through space. And so we're working with Change, which is connecting habitat across New Jersey as part of NJDEP to target areas for restoration that would connect habitat for animals to be able to move through space, whether it's for breeding or food resources and other types of habitat needs. And again, the folks over with Change at NGDEP have been, everybody that we work with has just been so helpful and so knowledgeable. And we really value their knowledge and their expertise and, you know, being able to take that information, implement it, and then also bring the public in and have them participate in those restoration projects.
To me, that's awesome. And, you know, something, bobcats are very elusive too. So getting to sight one of them, if there was an abundance of them, sometimes is difficult. And when there's not as many, just that would put a smile on any outdoors woman's face, just to be able to see one out there in nature, without a doubt. One I love also are snakes. And I had asked you a question about some of the snakes that are found out in the Sourlands. Can you discuss a few of those?
Sure. I know I personally have seen a garter snake and a brown snake, but I will confess that I'm a little bit of a snakeophobe. I am afraid of them, so I don't generally go looking for them. But a friend of mine, she had an eastern milk snake in her house. Which I think I might have fainted if that happened to me. And I know there are northern copperheads in the Sourlands. Again, I have not seen one personally, but we know that they are here. And there's a couple other snakes that are in the region, but because I haven't seen them personally, I don't want to expound that, yes, they all are here, but there is a big list of snakes in the central New Jersey region.
And you know this, we were chatting, I recorded and released this week's podcast show is actually on the copperhead snake. So people can check that one out. They shouldn't leave this show to listen to that show because they need to listen to this one before they go there. Also, you mentioned about a stopover for migratory birds. And in my back pond, I had a few buffleheads recently. And it's cool. They're just stopping by. Grab the binos, the spotting scope, you enjoy them, and then they move on. And that's the great thing. And we're also so close to the Delaware River. And because the Delaware River with migratory as a stopover, that's just an awesome place to be.
Absolutely. And, you know, during the summertime, my favorite thing to see here is the scarlet tanager.
Yes.
You're going to see that in like a deep forest, and in the summertime you can see them, the Sourlands, and you see this bright red, and you're like, what is that? Because it's more intense than a cardinal, and it's just stunning, and you don't get birds like that unless you have a deep forest. That's the type of habitat they need, and we want to make sure that birds like that can come up here, because when they go back to South America, they go and they pick bugs off chocolate and the cacao plants and coffee plants. So we really want to make sure when they come up here, they have something to, place for them to breed and to raise their young, and then they go back down there and they save our chocolate and coffee.
Hey, saving chocolate and coffee for most people in America, that's an important deal.
Yep. And it's a beautiful bird on top of that. So
absolutely.
Double thumbs up.
Absolutely on that one. Now, there was a program and I just thought it was awesome. And I had heard about it, but a little bit more about it. The Amphibian Crossing Guard program. Why don't you discuss that? That's a cool program.
Yeah, so we work with Mercer County Park Commission for the Amphibian Crossing Guard program. So amphibians will hibernate during the winter time, during the cold months. They'll, have little burrows in the ground, or they'll be, some will hibernate under a stream bed. But then in the spring, when the soil starts to warm up, they wake up to breed. And so it's usually one of the first warm nights of March. And by warm, I mean about 40 degrees and rainy. It has to be really wet. These amphibians will start migrating to vernal pools to breed. And unfortunately, many times where they spend most of their year and where they're hibernating is on the other side of a road from their vernal pool. Not always, but there's a lot of roads in New Jersey, right? We're one of the most densely populated states. So unfortunately, while they're migrating on these rainy March and April nights, they'll get hit by a car. And so one car going by on a road every 40 minutes can wipe out about 70% of the population of say the spotted salamander or any other amphibian. So it's a really big deal. And one call every 4 minutes is not that much traffic, but it's enough to really devastate a population. So the amphibian crossing guards will go out on these really rainy, cool nights in March, and they will count the amphibians that are crossing the road. So they count who's migrating. They also count, unfortunately, who is doesn't make it across the road, and they get an idea of the population size and of these amphibians. And that's really important because we want to be able to monitor these populations. So we hold a training with Mercer County Park Commission in the early or late winter, usually around January or February, to get everybody prepared for this crossing. Crossing guards work in teams and they wear reflective gear. And we do not stop traffic. We don't want to lose any human life, but we put out signs and we try to really encourage people to not drive on rainy nights in March and April. Just stay home, pull out that frozen pizza from your freezer and just stay put and let those amphibians cross and breed. So that's that program. And it's phenomenal. And people come out and they do it every year.
Well, the first mistake you just made with me is being a Goomba Italian. It's illegal for me to ever eat a frozen pizza. We make our own homemade. That's the first piece.
Fair enough.
And then the second one is, you always hear about why the chicken crossed the road, but now we're in a serious sense, why did the amphibian cross the road? And this is an important now part. And again, it's getting locals involved. And that's what it's like. If there's one common denominator between all the restoration projects, the clean water, the protecting the invasive species, the amphibian crossings, all of this, it is getting locals involved. There's experts like you that are out there, or the invasive strike team where we can go get answers, but it is those locals that are there. And I am sure the listeners right now, because some of them may not live in the area, because we have people that travel, especially with the amphibian crossing. I know one of my friends travels quite a distance to participate in that. So if anyone wants to get involved and make a positive impact on the Sourlands, how could they get involved?
Well, they could become a member of the Sourland Conservancy, or they could join our newsletter. You can do that by going to our website, www.sourland.org. You can also email us at info@sourland.org and become a volunteer. The best way to find out about a training if you want to become an amphibian crossing guard is to sign up for our newsletter. We always send out information prior to any type of training. And just get involved and read. There's a lot of information on our website about all the incredible diverse animal and plant communities and the geology of this region and the history of this region. I mean, I think a lot of times people think of New Jersey and they think of the Turnpike. They haven't really experienced a lot of New Jersey, and the Sourlands is kind of this hidden gem in central New Jersey, between Philly and New York City. It's an incredible place. And, especially during times like these where it's so hard and you can't, go out and commune with other people, you can go out and you can commune with nature. So, check out our website, become a member, look at our trail maps, get out in the trails and, experience the beauty of this region.
Well, Carolyn, you have educated, you educated many people, but you absolutely educated me today. I just wanted to thank you personally for coming on to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
No, this is awesome. And I just thank you so much. And there's so much information that people can now either listen to or via going onto your conservancy site and finding out information and finding out how to get involved. And to me, that's what getting into nature is all about, is having people like yourself able to commune with other people to get them to be involved. So once again, I thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Until next time, enjoy life's adventures.
You can follow all of my adventures online at joeybee.tv. That's joeybee.tv. And a very special thank you to the men and women of our armed forces for keeping us free, and for our police and firefighters for keeping us safe. May God bless America. Until next time, this is Joey B. Enjoy life's adventures.